In all honesty, one must observe that in the late Middle Ages, we find trends in theology which would sunder this synthesis between the Greek spirit and the Christian spirit. In contrast with the so-called intellectualism of Augustine and Thomas, there arose with Duns Scotus a voluntarism which, in its later developments, led to the claim that we can only know God's voluntas ordinata. Beyond this is the realm of God's freedom, in virtue of which he could have done the opposite of everything he has actually done. This gives rise to positions which clearly approach those of Ibn Hazm and might even lead to the image of a capricious God who is not even bound to truth and goodness. God's transcendence and otherness are so exalted that our reason, our sense of the true and good, are no longer an authentic mirror of God, whose deepest possibilities remain eternally unattainable and hidden behind his actual decisions. As opposed to this, the faith of the church has always insisted that between God and us, between his eternal creator spirit and our created reason, there exists a real analogy in which, as the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 stated, unlikeness remains infinitely greater than likeness, yet not to the point of abolishing analogy and its language. God does not become more divine when we push him away from us in a sheer, impenetrable voluntarism. Rather, the truly divine God is the God who has revealed himself as Logos, and as Logos has acted and continues to act lovingly on our behalf. Certainly, love, as St. Paul says, transcends knowledge and is thereby capable of perceiving more than thought alone. Nonetheless, it continues to be love of the God who is Logos. Consequently, Christian worship is again, to quote Paul, quote, worship in harmony with the eternal word and with our reason, unquote. This inner rapprochement between biblical faith and Greek philosophical inquiry was an event of decisive importance, not only from the standpoint of the history of religions, but also from that of world history. It is an event which concerns us even today. Given this convergence, it is not surprising that Christianity, despite its origins and some significant developments in the East, finally took on its historically decisive character in Europe. We can also express this the other way around. This convergence, with the subsequent addition of the Roman heritage, created Europe and remains the foundation of what can rightly be called Europe. The thesis that the critically purified Greek heritage forms an integral part of Christian faith has been countered by the call for a de-Hellenization of Christianity, a call which has more and more dominated theological discussions since the beginning of the modern age. Viewed more closely, three stages can be observed in the program of de-Hellenization. Although interconnected, they are clearly distinct from one another in their motivations and objectives. De-Hellenization first emerges in connection with the postulates of the Reformation in the 16th century. Looking at the tradition of scholastic theology, the Reformers thought they were confronted with a faith system totally conditioned by philosophy. That is to say, an articulation of the faith based on an alien system of thought. As a result, faith no longer appeared as a living historical word, but as one element of an overarching philosophical system. The principle of sola scriptura, on the other hand, sought faith in its pure primordial form, as originally found in the biblical word. Metaphysics appeared as a premise derived from another source, from which faith had to be liberated in order to become once more fully itself. When Kant stated that he needed to set thinking aside in order to make room for faith, he carried this program forward with a radicalism that the reformers could never have foreseen. He thus anchored faith exclusively in practical reason, denying it access to reality as a whole.